You're probably wondering, now whom would he choose this time? Our saint for meditation today is Saint Andrew Bobola, B-O-B-O-L-A. We already had one saint from Poland, remember? Stanislaus. And now we have another. Of the 70 provinces in the Society of Jesus, the two that are giving us most vocations are the two provinces of Poland, behind the Iron Curtain. In other words, affluence, money, and prosperity does not help vocations. He was born of a Polish family in a town called Sandomir in 1591 and died in May 1657. He entered the Society of Jesus at Vilna in Lithuania in 1609. At the time when he entered, it was part of Poland, that is, Lithuania was. Immediately after his ordination, he became a preacher in the Church of St. Casimir, again in Vilna. After some time as preacher, he was made superior of his community in a town called Bobrinsk, B-O-B-R-I-N-S-K. During his rectorship, as we call it, he was devoted especially to the sick and the dying during a siege of epidemic. Then for the next 20 years, he went back to his preaching. Among the Jesuits, we have certain men that over the centuries now have been simply appointed as preachers. There are some that are just teachers, and a few that try to combine teaching and preaching and a little writing on the side. During his preaching, and it was an itinerant kind of preaching, he brought whole villages back to the church. To recall the geography of Poland and Lithuania, Lithuania now absorbed, of course, in the Soviet Union, but it was at that time overridden by the Orthodox, because so many of the Orthodox wanted to control that part of the country. In other words, the Catholics in Lithuania and in Poland were opposed by the Orthodox who were in power in the Russian Empire. At any rate, Andrew, through his preaching, converted many of the Orthodox back to the Catholic faith. At the same time, he converted not a few lax Catholics. Remember all the while that the Orthodox once they broke with Roman unity and became the rulers of Russia for centuries. The czars of Russia were Orthodox, but the czars were related by blood to the patriarchs of Moscow, the same Romanov family that was head of the Russian church was also head of the Russian Empire. In other words, the relationship, in fact, the union between church and state was so close that Catholics, well, millions were lost to the faith because the rulers were Orthodox. Even as in the 16th and 17th centuries, millions of Catholics were lost to the faith because the rulers were Protestants. Same idea. Andrew Bobola's success in preaching and converting both the Orthodox and the lax Catholics aroused opposition both among the Catholics that he was converting and especially among the Orthodox in the military, who were known as Cossacks. In other words, it's simply a transliteration from the Russian. They were the Russian military. All the while that Andrew was being opposed because of his successful preaching, he never lost patience, because the Orthodox, though they finally, as we know, did him to death, but before that happened, the Orthodox did everything in their power to break down his resistance. Like what? He'd come into a village to preach. The people, stirred up by their leaders, rounded up children, which made it especially difficult to take. This went on for years, and the children would follow Bobola wherever he went. He was trying to preach, and they were told to shout and scream and see all kinds of abusive things to distract and distress him and discourage him from preaching. Well, he didn't lose patience. That went on for 20 years. In the meantime, the Russians began waging a war against the Polish people. As you know, the Polish people, in their centuries of history, have had only a short time of national independence. This was one of the periods after which then Russia took over one half and Germany the other half. As a result, the Polish Jesuits were driven out of their churches and their colleges, and forbidden to teach or conduct religious services. But being driven from one place, they went to another. They went to marshlands and swamps, which they proceeded to dry out and clean up, and got the people to follow them, because the people's faith was, of course, being crushed by being deprived of their priests. At this point, a Polish prince gave the Jesuits residence in a town called Pinsk, P-I-N-S-K, Pinsk. Sir Andrew then found lodging, and it was the last 5 years of his life. Finally, the town fell to the Cossacks, and then began what the Pope who canonized St. Andrew said in his judgment: it was the most horrible martyrdom in the Church's history. I've got it down to 16 items. First of all, as the leader of the people, Andrew was taken captive by the Cossacks, one of the soldiers, tied Andrew to the back of his horse, and ran the horse at full gallop for miles to a town called Jano. Needless to say, by this time Andrew was being dragged, and mutilated, to put it mildly. But that was only the beginning. He was told to abjure his faith. Now keep this in mind. This is one thing I want to bring out as we get deeper into this great man's life and martyrdom. Remember, the principal article of the Catholic faith denied by the Orthodox, and which Andrew died in defending, was the authority of the Pope. My first prayer book was in Russian. Many of my near relatives associating with and some Orthodox, I know exactly what the dividing line is. It's the Pope. Andrew refused to abjure his faith, which meant denying that the Pope is visible head of the Church. Every time he answered in the negative to demands for abjuration, he was mercilessly beaten. During these questionings, after being beaten with fists Every time he answered that he wouldn't, he was lashed with a sword. But he must have had a strong body by this time. He should have died. So they took him to the town slaughterhouse where cattle were killed. He was stripped of his clothes and applying a blowtorch, his body was burnt from head to foot, and he was still alive. The torch they used was the one used in slaughterhouses to scorch hogs after being slaughtered. Then they began scourging with metal scourges. Still alive. Then they hacked off his nose. Then his ears. Then his lips were cut out of his mouth. Then, having drilled a hole in his throat just to increase the pain, they pulled his tongue out through his throat. In the meantime, in mockery of his priesthood, they cut the front and the back of his body in the shape of a chasuble so that his flesh dangled in front and back. He prayed all the while. The more he prayed, the more it infuriated his tormentors, and they attacked him still more savagely. They couldn't believe it. He was still living. Then, to make sure he would die, they hacked off his head and dumped his body on a dung heap. In 1730, that would be 63 years after his death. By that time, his cause for canonization was introduced. His remains were exhumed because the faithful then did bury the body, decapitated. And his body was found miraculously incorrupt. And the wounds were still fresh. He was canonized in 1938, and his body was mysteriously stolen by the communists. And yet somewhere in Soviet Russia. Though it may, for all we know by now, have been destroyed. And that mainly because of the great veneration of the faithful, which his relics incorrupt the veneration among the faithful. Now something about his spirituality. In other words, what does Andrew Bobola teach us? I have seven things that he can teach us. The only reason I stopped at seven is to make sure I'd finish in time. First of all, martyrdom is a great grace. In order to merit that grace, as far as we can speak of meriting, a person must have lived a good life. One of the most fascinating studies is to reread the lives of the martyrs before they were killed for the faith. It's remarkable how holy their lives were before they were sealed with blood. Not just anybody is a martyr. And one reason, quite frankly, is that in God's providence, martyrs are intended to witness not only to that momentary, or in this day, this case, hours long, being put to death, but their martyrdom is to witness to also their preceding life. Secondly, Andrew tells us something about apostolic zeal. Your community is dedicated to pray and sacrifice for priests. Oh, pray and sacrifice that our priests may be zealous. Just because a man is ordained a priest, often a mere youngster, I was spared that by being ordained on my 33rd birthday. So I was no fledgling. But as soon as a man is ordained, the faith of the people recognizes in that youngster a man specially consecrated to God. I've given too many talks and retreats to priests. I told you, didn't I, I'm going to be in New Mexico for 9 days, talking to the priests next month. I tell them, a priest is to exhaust himself in search of souls. Don't set up office hours and wait for the calls to come in. Go out after them. Who do you think you are? It is blasphemous to suppose that Christ would set up an office and have hours telling his Jewish contemporaries to come. He went out after them. That's Andrew. Hampus don't exist. And that zeal, we know, was not only exhausting, it was in so many ways humiliating, with those youngsters screeching. Sometimes when I'm preaching in church, for example, a young mother with a young baby, grandpa baby, flexing its muscles, begins to scream. The mother does everything in her power. Hush. The child doesn't hush. She puts her hand over his mouth. There's a different kind of a sound. But it continues. And I more than once told the mothers, look, I enjoy it. And I really do. Compared to Andrew's putting up with those howling youngsters. Again, Andrew teaches us that if you want to bring souls to Christ, you've got to pay a heavy price. We read St. Paul, in which he describes what he had to go through, remember? He runs out of vocabulary. All the things that he was subjected to in his proclaiming and preaching of the Master. Andrew knew his Saint Paul. To proclaim Jesus means you must pay the price. Fourth feature, and this is the gem. It was because of his loyalty to the Bishop of Rome, the Vicar of Christ, that in the last analysis, Andrew Bapola worked so hard trying to convert the Orthodox, who denied this one article. They've got the seven sacraments, they've got the Mass, they've got an episcopate, they've got the priesthood, but they don't believe in the Pope's primacy. And then finally he was murdered by those who told him to abjure the primacy and all would be well. Let me tell you, let me say it as emphatically as I can without raising my voice. The acid test of a good Catholic today is his loyalty to the Pope. You believe that? Believe it. A Teresa cane symbolizes the anti-papal religious woman. Hans Kuhn symbolizes the anti-papal priest. Pray, he's coming back to the States next month to teach at the University of Michigan. Bishop Shannon in Old Minnesota, with whom I had lunch 6 weeks before he left the Episcopate, symbolizes the anti-papal bishop. And what then do you expect the laity? No wonder. No wonder. Just read at noon that 73% of American Catholics, I hope the figure is wrong, but at least one survey, 73% of lay Catholics believe in contraception. Is it any wonder? The Pope says it's a mortal sin. So in one seminary after another, contraception is left, so the saying goes, to the conscience of each person. I have to say this. The single book in the United States that I think that has done more damage than any volume its size is Wilhelm's, Wilhelm, his book, Christ Among Us, published by the Paulist Press. The announced sales so far last month were 1.5 million copies. The author left the priesthood, and the book keeps being sold. The first imprimatur was from Cardinal Dearden. The present imprimatur is from Archbishop Garrity of Newark. And contraception is canonized. My God! My God! Who is a Catholic? That's why we need, I won't be able to exhaust all the Jesuit saints in the month I'll be with you. I'm choosing, you may be sure, my conferences. But how desperately we need it. The intercession in heaven and the example for us on earth of a man who shed his blood and how treacherously he was murdered to defend the authority of the Pope. We need that. How we need his example. Andrew Bobola teaches us something about Christian courage. We know, and by now we've read enough about courageous people to know that courage or fortitude somehow means strength, firmness. However, I touched on this before, but I want to make it clearer here. There is an unchristian courage, which is a virtue, all right, but is not precisely Christian. It is the strength and the firmness it takes to undertake some difficult enterprise. you might say that Caesar, leading the Roman soldiers, had courage. Napoleon had courage. The men and women of our day who undertake breathtaking enterprises, like a Lindbergh, crossing the Atlantic in that toy plane, to courage, alone, with none of the instruments we've got now. Talk about pioneering, courage. And we admire that kind of virtue. I'll take a little extra time here because it's so important. That is surely a true virtue. But when Christ came into the world, he said he would elevate, remember? He did not remove, he said, the law and the prophets, but perfect them, raise them. He raised the virtue of courage to heights it never had before by doing what? Watch the language. Courage, as the world understands it, and legitimately, is the virtue of undertaking a difficult task. Christ elevated courage by making it, undergoing great trial. You see the difference? Without denying, call it courage number one, courage number two, or Christian courage, does not require that I undertake or start or pioneer or, as the language goes, dare something that maybe no one else before me had the courage to do. Christian courage, because it was Christ's courage, is the strength that only God can give to undergo. Where the suffering is imposed, where the trial is caused by somebody else, and where I patiently endure. That's Christian courage at its purest. Am I clear? Someone else causes me the suffering or pain. In Andrew's case, we got some idea. And my firmness in undergoing the pain that I am caused by someone else. Ah, that is courage indeed. Where I don't even get credit for doing anything glamorous. The only satisfaction I get, but the only one I want, is the realization that I am following in the footsteps of my Master. And if you read the Passion of Christ, you'll find that's why in the last analysis Christ was crucified. The Jews expected him to use the kind of courage that their great military leaders, like a David, for example, centuries before, the kind of courage that would conquer the Romans, this can't be the Messiah. There must be some mistake. He must be a pseudo-prophet. Do you follow the logic? A man who just takes it and takes it and keeps taking it, and then when dying on the cross looks down at his executioners and asks his Father to forgive them. That's the lesson that Calvary teaches us, and that Andrabobola, in imitation of his crucified Lord, witness in our day. We're not quite finished. The first kind of courage may or may not have the help of divine grace, because frankly, some of the heroes and heroines of history who exhibited courage number one performed such misdeeds with their vaunted courage, we can hardly say that God assisted them, right? When Napoleon had a whole town executed, innocent people, if that took courage, so be it. But that is not the courage that is blessed by God. But this kind of courage is simply not able to be practiced by a human being by his own strength. You need grace. And I have three prepositions that I have come to use in this context. And Andrew is a perfect model. His strength, as his dying prayers, because there were people who witnessed what he was saying and recalled and recorded. He was asking Our Lady and her Son for strength. It was therefore strength that he received from Christ. Christ alone could give that kind of courage. It is strength that he received in order to suffer for Christ. It is courage he received in order to suffer like Christ. All of this is what Andrew showed in his dying hours. There is still one item that I dare not omit. Just before his tongue was pulled out, when he could no longer speak, just before that, bystanders heard him asking, "Lord, keep me from denying my faith so I won't be lost in hell." Isn't that good to hear? In other words, it is not only the love of Christ that should motivate us to suffer and, if need be, die for Him. It is also the fear of being punished by Christ and being estranged from Christ. In other words, Andrababola's martyrdom was motivated, of course, by a deep love of Jesus Christ, but also by the fear of being deprived of the company of Christ for all eternity. Let us ask the saint whose memory we are speaking about today to obtain for his suffering people the courage they need in now being persecuted by their enemies, and especially for our Holy Father, who more than once has spoken to his people about imitating Andrababola in courageously proclaiming Jesus crucified. Saint Andrababola, pray for us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.